rains. Kirsten was still in high school, and compared to me then, she was so young. She was super nice, and we would go out of our way to include her whenever we could. Her mom hosted barbecues, and we would all go because we wanted Kirsten to feel like part of the gang. You went, you ate, and you turned to the person next to you, "What bar are we going to?" The movie came out and surprised everyone. We made $90 million, and it's become a cult classic. Soccer dads will come up to me and start doing the cheers, the "brr, it's cold in here" routine, then ask me if they're doing it right. I have to answer, "Dude, I have no idea. Sorry." I worked hard to make Isis a real character. It is interesting to me that when people reenact my scenes, they turn me back into that meow caricature the director and I consciously took steps to avoid. They snap their fingers and say, "It's already been broughten." That line is actually from a later spoof of teen movies, but perception is reality. Isis was an educated leader who refused to have her cheers stolen, but these people genuinely believe she was the villain. A bunch of us did a cast reunion and photo shoot for a magazine a couple of years back. Kirsten was there, and I mentioned how people say the "it's already been broughten" line at me, even though it wasn't in the scene she and I played. "It wasn't?" she said, laughing. "I thought it was." Perception is reality. Sometimes it's the director's perception of you that can ruin a project. I get asked about Friends a lot because people know there were only two black people on the show who didn't play something like a waiter or Chandler's coworker. That leaves Aisha Tyler and me. For some reason, people get our plot lines confused. Aisha played the woman pursued by Joey and Ross. I played the woman pursued by Joey and Ross. Okay, I get it now. When I was on, it was their seventh season when Friends started to have more stunt guest stars. Susan Sarandon, Kristen Davis, Winona Ryder, Gary Oldman, and me. I heard I got the gig on a Tuesday, the morning after my CBS hospital drama, City of Angels, was canceled. The best part of that show, by the way, was working with Blair Underwood. The sixth grader in me was dying. The worst part was having to yell, "Pumping up epinephrine," and screwing it up each time. You try it. I had heard CBS gave great Christmas gifts, so my goal was to try to hang on until Christmas. We didn't make it. When I drove onto the Warner Brothers lot, I was not scheming to become best friends with the Friends. I was okay with that. By then, I had done 1,001 guest roles, and I understood how these shows worked. If you're a regular, especially megastars grinding through your seventh season, you have so much on your plate that going out of your way to befriend your guest star is the last thing on your priority list. But they were all really nice and totally professional. I thought, okay, this could be cool. They had it down to a science and only needed 3 or 4 days to bang out an episode. My first scene was on the street outside Central Perk, with me unloading the back of a car, announcing that I am moving into the neighborhood. Briefly, apparently. The director was a regular. He did a lot of episodes. He went over the scene with David Schwimmer, Matt Perry, and the extras. Then he turned to me, and his tone completely changed. "Do you know what a mark is?" he said in a sing-song voice. "You stay on that so the camera can see you." It was like he was talking to a toddler. He assumed on sight that I didn't know a single thing. "Don't worry," I said. "I know." Of course I knew what a mark was. Did he talk to other guest stars like this? The same thing happened in my next scene, this one with Matt LeBlanc. "Okay," the director continued in the sing-song voice he reserved for me. He mimed how I should hold a lamp. "You could do this," he said, "or this." His tone was so condescending, as if I had just wandered in off the street or won a contest for a friend's walk-on. It's funny, because I was standing there with Matt LeBlanc. I had 4 films under my belt that had either opened at number 1 at the box office or at number 2 behind blockbusters like The Freakin' Matrix. Matt, meanwhile, had a movie with a monkey. Yet the director was talking to me, his guest star, as if I hadn't accomplished a single thing. It's telling, I think, that my scenes were not in the usual Friends settings. First, I was outside Central Perk, a street set that fans know to be pretty rarely used on the show. Then Joey and Ross went inside Central Perk to discuss me, and then I showed up again with both of them at an obviously fake bar. My black face didn't darken the door of their favorite cafe, and certainly not the Friends' apartments. In their ninth year, Aisha Tyler had the weight of integrating the Friends set and storyline like some sort of Ruby Bridges of must-see TV. They let her character, Charlie Wheeler, stay for 9 episodes. In 2003, Entertainment Weekly suggested it was odd that the two black girls were given the exact same storyline. The déjà vu wouldn't be that notable except that Friends' depiction of New York City is notoriously lily white. Executive producer David Crane took umbrage. The other storyline with Union was quick and funny, where the two guys didn't realize they were dating the same girl, he told the magazine. Charlie Wheeler, Tyler, is a brilliant paleontologist who should be dating someone like Ross, but hooks up with Joey first. Got it. By 2016, the whitewashing of the Friends world was so apparent in reruns and streaming that series co-creator Marta Kaufman had to acknowledge the situation to the Washington Post. That is a criticism we have heard quite a bit, Kaufman said. When we cast the show, we didn't say to ourselves, this is going to be an all-white cast. But it was. I didn't call the director on the way he treated me, which I regret. I thought, no wonder you don't have black talent on this show. He assumed I didn't know anything, and he felt comfortable dismissing me with condescending directives. It's actually not enough to just point out that there were so few black actors on the show. We need to look at why, and why it was assumed that I knew nothing. Bias, whether implicit or explicit, hits every industry. To be a black person is to understand what it is to be automatically infantilized and to have it be assumed that you don't have the talent or the skill set required to do your job. It's the reason Dr. Tamika Cross, a chief resident in OBGYN, was stopped from helping a man who fell unconscious on her flight. When they asked if there was a doctor who could help, Tamika went into action and was denied. Oh, no, sweetie, Dr. Cross recalled the flight attendant saying. Put your hand down. We're looking for actual physicians or nurses or some kind of medical personnel. We don't have time to talk to you. To compare myself to a doctor is a leap. I know, but it's just how people talk to us. So no, I couldn't possibly know where my mark was. My short time on the Friends set was a lesson, though. I had grown as an actress, raised my salary quote, and proved I could open films. But it wasn't enough. I thought about that speech Dad gave me before I started elementary school. You're gonna have to be bigger, badder, better, just to be considered equal. You're gonna have to do twice as much work, and you're not going to get any credit. It was still true, even in the land of make-believe. Chapter 10, Crash and Burn Marriage. Have you ever had a dream where you're in a car and you're heading right for a wall? You're trying to hit the brakes, but you just speed closer and closer to your doom? Well, you are cordially invited to my first wedding. May 5th, 2001 was a hot day, even for New Orleans. My bridesmaids were all hungover, their faces puffy and shiny from frozen daiquiris and hurricanes, a peril of having your wedding during Jazz Fest. Just before the ceremony, they were rock-paper-scissoring to see who got to go down the aisle with the Heisman winners. The loser had to walk with the groom's friend who was just sprung from jail. He'd made bail in a murder case and was still wearing prison braids, as fuzzy as his alibi. Their game of rock-paper-scissors was a convenient distraction from what I was pretty sure could be a heart attack. But once they all walked, it was just me, myself, and my anxiety standing at the beginning of an aisle that now seemed a country mile long. At the end was Chris, someone I had no business marrying. I took a step, and my shaking started with the first chords of Endless Love. I was on the edge of sobs, but not the usual wedding tears of a bride overcome by emotion. Everyone could tell, especially my father. He looped his arm through mine to escort me, which is to say, drag me, down the aisle. "Stop it," he hissed in my ear. "Stop this right now. You're back at Foothill High School. You're the point guard. You're leading your team. Stop this foolishness." I nodded, trying to turn my ugly cry into a game face. Two guests I didn't recognize jumped in front of the videographer to take photos. They paused a beat, each lowering their disposable cameras and smiling as if giving direction, like maybe I'd get the idea and be happy. Chris and I hadn't thought to write the number of guests allowed on the response card, so our wedding planner had simply seated, say, 15 people on a card that went to one cousin. "The girl from Bring It On is marrying that football player, so invite the whole block," I imagine them saying. "Well, yeah, he got cut from the Jacksonville Jaguars, but he's hoping to be a Raider." As Dad held me up down the aisle, I saw that the pastor that Chris's mother had insisted we use was not there. My family is Catholic, but Chris wouldn't commit to doing the pre-Cana classes you have to take in order to get married by a priest. His mother's suddenly precious pastor had skipped the rehearsal. I thought if he was a no-show, that would be my out. Then I saw him blending in and chatting with the groomsmen, mingling at my wedding ceremony. I had asked one of my closest guy friends, Dulé Hill, to do a reading. He was playing Charlie on the West Wing at the time, and I had been his girlfriend on the show. Dulé thought this marriage was a terrible mistake. So as he read from Corinthians, he kept sighing dramatically, pausing to look at me like, "Are you getting this?" "Love is patient," he said. "Love is kind." After an eye roll, he continued, ticking off all the boxes on what was wrong with my relationship. "It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others." Long pause. Tick, tick, tick. I heard a plane in the distance. "It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs." If Chris and I had kept no record of wrongs, we would have had nothing to talk about. His endless cheating had given me permission to cheat too. I was just less sloppy about it, so he wasn't aware. While he dealt in volume, I dealt in quality. A note for the novice cheater: never, ever cheat with someone who has less to lose than you. You want someone who will be more inclined to keep his or her mouth shut. "Who gives this woman to be married to this man?" the pastor asked, his voice thick with Louisiana country. Chris suddenly turned his back on me. I remember it in slow motion, him stepping down from the altar and moving toward his groomsmen. I was being left at the altar, I thought. This was really happening. I had missed my chance to run, and now he was Julia freaking Roberts, the runaway groom riding off on a horse. "He knows," I thought. "He knows I cheated on him, and he won't marry trash." Chris leaned in with his groomsmen, taking a huddle. They stamped their feet in unison, all turning back to me with a football chant of, "We do!" It was a joke. Chris had planned this. He wasn't leaving me. He didn't know I was trash. I was saved from shame and washed with relief. I could endure a toxic marriage, but the humiliation of being left, of being publicly rejected, that would have been too much. The pastor began the vows. "Do you, Gabriel, take Christopher to be your lawfully wedded husband?" Wait, I thought. Gabriel? This guy just mispronounced my name at my own wedding. But I was raised to never correct people, certainly not a pastor. All I needed to do was say my name the right way when I repeated the vows. But because I was a good Catholic girl, I said it wrong. "I, Gabriel, take..." A groan went up from the bridesmaids. I glanced back at their disbelieving faces, then over at Dulé, ready with the faintest shake of his head. I smiled at Chris, which is something I always do to another actor when I am nervous in a scene and just want to get through it. I had a hard time looking at him, so my eyes settled on his forehead. The pastor pronounced us man and wife, and our exit song down the aisle was Natalie Cole's This Will Be. It's a cockeyed ode to bliss that now seems a little too on-the-nose irony-wise. Our videographer walked backwards in front of us, capturing the exact moment one of our groomsmen, a huge guy named Zeus, clapped us on the back. "Y'all's married now," he said, riffing on a Color Purple line with a voice full of forced wonder and excitement. On the video, which I have watched only once, you see my face fall. It was the beginning of the end. So, what got me there? Well, my roommate in 1999 had a thing for linebackers in the AFC Central Division. Her taste was very specific, and I can't fault her for it because they were actually all great guys. One in particular hosted a 3-day party in Jacksonville, Florida, every April. My roommate and I went one year with some friends, and on the first night, there was a bowling party. I immediately clocked this guy in the next lane. Definitely not my type. He was a running back, short and built, and a Jacksonville Jaguars teammate had given him the nickname Little Thicky. That was an accurate description. He had on these baggy jeans, and he'd cut off the hems to shorten them. Later, when I was shopping for him, I learned that a 38-28 is, in fact, a mean size to find. "What are you, Huck Finn?" I asked, looking down at his frayed cuffs. "My name's Chris." "Where's Jim? He out watching the raft?" He gave it right back, trash-talking my game. He was legit funny, a country boy from Kenner, Louisiana, where they take turtles out of the swamp to cook them. He liked drinking dark liquor and playing cards, and he reminded me of the kind of men who married into my family. The contrast was that he also had tattoos all over his arms, two earrings, and an easy cartoon cat smile. When we were all leaving, he got on a Ducati, and that sealed it. As a child of Grease 2, I was always on the lookout for a cool rider. I found myself thinking about him, and the next night he showed up at the house where most of us were staying. One of my girlfriends was like, "He's downstairs." He had come back, so that meant he was interested too. It's funny, in retrospect, how excited I was. We spent the rest of the party weekend joined at the hip, hanging out and trading pot shots. A big part of our courtship was ragging on each other. Sure, later we would use it as a weapon, having learned what to say to wound and what would be the kill shot. But in the beginning, it was good fun. It felt like a mutual chase. We would visit each other in Jacksonville and L.A. for weekends. My career was just starting to rise, so the arrangement was good. I could focus on work and auditions while he did his training. We had dreams. After football, "I'm one class away from my kinesiology degree from Michigan," he told me. "I want to go into sports medicine." In July, after 3 months of dating, Chris bought an engagement ring, but he held on to it until my birthday at the end of October. I flew to Jacksonville to celebrate. I spent the whole day at the spa, and when I got back to his house, there was a rose petal path from the front door to the bedroom. At the end was Chris, down on one knee. He had a bucket of KFC on the floor, and he was eating KFC potato wedges with one hand while holding a ring in the other. When I tell this story to new girlfriends, they always ask tentatively if there was some sentimental thing about KFC. No, I have to tell them. In the first of a list of many ignored red flags, I guess he was eating and I had surprised him. The ring felt big and special, and so many of my friends were already married. I'd won something under the wire, I thought. I was the girl who called everyone to share my news, but I remember feeling more and more apprehensive with each call. I'm the opposite of impetuous. I am a measure 16 times, then cut once person, and then torture myself in the middle of the night about how I kind of did a half-assed job on that 16th measurement. So I got defensive when the general response was, "Are you sure?" and, "As long as you're happy..." People thought it was a terrible idea, given that I'd only known him a few months and I'd only seen him on random weekends. People on the other side of marriage know what happens when you've never spent any real time together. I had no idea what that reality actually looked like, but I told myself I was just deficient. The next day, I had to fly up to Wilmington to audition for Dawson's Creek. It was a quick trip, there and back in one day. Back in Jacksonville, I let myself into Chris's place while he was still at practice and got on his computer to check my email. Kids, this was medieval times when old-timey laptops used to have messages pop up on the screen like they were breaking in with a special report. And there it was. Yo, you still got that girl coming in next weekend? Nigga, she's Greek. Nigga, she's Greek. This was from his best friend. Now, I am not Greek, nor do I know why his friend was so insistent about this woman's Greek identity. All I knew was that I was going to be back in L.A. the weekend of Greek Fest, and this was literally not even 24 hours after he had proposed to me. I packed my bag and kept my ring on just so he could see me take it off when I threw it at him. When he walked in the door, I nailed it, throwing the diamond right at him. Chris entered the scene in full apology mode as his boy had tipped him off. I guess my reply, something like, "Yes, what was her name again?" gave away that the person typing wasn't Chris. He bent to pick up the ring and was crawling on the ground, begging. "You just proposed," I yelled. "I didn't know if you were going to say yes," he said. "So you lined up a backup?" I yelled. "Who do you think you're kidding?" But for someone with an intense fear of public humiliation who just hours ago felt lucky to have been chosen, I had no choice but to stay. I didn't have it in me to call all those people 24 hours later and say, "You were right," because then everyone would know just how naive and foolish I really was. The judgment, I imagined, would be on a grand scale. My publicist had also announced our engagement to the press, and I felt like there was no turning back. People had taken time to ask my publicist for details on how we met, and I had already crafted a quote about our happiness. "Yeah, about what I said," I dreaded saying. "Please respect our privacy during this difficult time." Now I know the headline would have been, "Eighth lead of She's All That calls off engagement." But in my mind, the story was far bigger. I stalled, putting off sending out the save the dates and stretching the engagement from 1999 all the way to 2001. When the Jaguars cut him in 2000, my girlfriends told me that I should too. But I couldn't kick him while he was down. I also believed he had a real skill set that would be attractive to another team. The Raiders were interested, and by the time we finally got married, he was doing off-season training with them. He was technically on the team and got a small stipend for working out, but he didn't have a contract. We married in May, and at the end of August, he got cut from the Raiders and never played football again. And for the rest of our marriage, never had another check from a job ever again. What about that kinesiology degree he was so close to getting? Funny, I asked the same question. "Yeah, about that," he said. "I'm actually a year and a half away. And if you're an ex-athlete on scholarship and don't tell the university that you want to come back in a certain amount of time, they don't budget for you. I'd be paying for it. Since I don't live in Michigan, I'd be paying out-of-state tuition." So the Bank of Gabrielle Union was officially open and doing a brisk business. I tried. Not much, mind you, but I did try. We were living in a cookie-cutter split-level townhouse in the Tarzana neighborhood of L.A., and he decided he needed office space for a company that, as far as I could tell, existed mainly in his mind. He'd convinced a few people to hire him as a marketing-type consulting person of some sort, and he was adamant he needed a plush office to be taken seriously. So I got him one by the Fox Lot in Century City. He needed to have that office feng shuied, by the way. Never been to Asia, but he needed it to be feng shuied to be on trend. I thought, if this will make you happy and productive, you do you. Neither happened. I started handing him ways to make me happy, gradually making them simpler and simpler. What was the name of that soul food place we saw in Sepulveda? I'd ask. Maybe we should go there some night. He upped his game, however, as a prolific cheater. I was resigned to it, more annoyed by his moping around than his cheating. I'd hear the garage door open and tense up, not sure what mood he'd be in. I distinctly remember yelling, "I don't care who sucks your dick. Just come home and be nice to me." Yet I would suddenly decide to get randomly, epically jealous. I was doing laundry one day and going through his pockets. Since it wasn't his money he was running around with, he could always be counted upon to put cash or credit cards through the wash. Sitting cross-legged on our bedroom floor, I found a piece of paper reading, "Angelina, 818, whatever, whatever." The ragey rage set in. I knew he was fucking other people, but finding that number set me off. I decided to stash the number on top of the armoire in our bedroom where it sat, waiting for the perfect moment for me to go ballistic when he accused me of something. Exhibit A. You're a dick. Prosecution rests. Case closed. It took a couple of weeks, but sure enough, he handed me just the right opportunity to go for it. I pulled down the number. "Is this the bitch?" I screamed, sounding like Rowdy Roddy Piper from the WWF. "Angelina? Is this the bitch you're fucking?" He laughed, right in my face. I became unhinged, fueled by embarrassment and anger. "You think you're gonna call this bitch?" I screamed. "You think you're gonna call this bitch?" Reader, I put the paper in my mouth. I chomped and chewed until I could swallow. "You're not calling this bitch," I said, coughing a little. Chris paused. "Angelina is the name of the soul food restaurant you asked me to find." I blinked. "Well," I said, "how does that taste?" Another time, we went 9 days straight without speaking. Ghosts in a split-level house finding reasons not to be in the same room. In the midst of this, I had a red carpet premiere that involved some sort of love theme, so I needed a date. Reporters had been picking up a Trouble in Paradise vibe with us, and I thought I had to keep up appearances. Hours before the event, he was downstairs watching TV, and I was upstairs thinking, how do I even get him to talk to me? And I hatched a plan I am not proud of. I bet if I was injured, he would have to talk to me. I went to the middle landing and then down a couple steps. By that time, I had done a couple of action movies, so I knew how to fake a fall without being injured. I tucked and rolled, slamming the wall where I knew he was sitting on the other side. "Baby!" he said, running to me. "Don't you baby me," I said, screaming and pretending to fight back tears. I pulled out the performance of my life. "You don't even want to talk to me, and now I've got to go to this premiere all alone, and I'm injured?" He went to the premiere. We smiled for the cameras. We played our roles. My drama moves weren't always successes. Like the night I ran away from home. Yes, my adult home. You know the moment in the movies where the girl runs off and the guy runs after her? Well, I tried my hand at that. Mid-fight, I literally ran out of my own house in shorts and a t-shirt. No wallet, no phone. I just started running, assuming Chris was going to run after me. But I forgot that I was in decent shape, so I just kept going. I ended up on the backside of a park, one where he played basketball. "He'll come find me here," I thought. I propped myself against a tree and waited, just so we could have this scene of, "Thank you for finding me." He never came. Instead, I fell asleep sitting against a tree. I woke up to the tingling feeling of a trail of ants climbing up my arm. Hello, rock bottom, I thought. It was after 4 a.m. and the sun was just starting to creep up. I had run so far from home that now I had to walk back. Step after step of utter Charlie Brown defeat. I held on to the glimmer of hope that Chris would be waiting at the door, frantic. I planned out my apology to the police, who I was certain would be swarming my house after Chris's call about a missing person. I just needed some air. When I got home, Chris was fast asleep up in our room, snoring to the heavens. He could not be bothered. You are right to wonder if we sought professional help. There were indeed forays into couples therapy. The first one, we had the luxury of choice. We were on the Titanic, asking to see the bar menu. We decided we wanted a black woman and a Christian woman at that. We thought she would shame us into being together. 15 minutes into our first session, before we even got to any of the tough stuff, she stopped us. This isn't gonna work, she said. You guys don't belong together. We'd been dumped. How dare she? I scoffed before we even got in the car. Who does she think she is? Snapped Chris. Oh, we were going to show that woman. Things got better for a little bit, in that every once in a while we would have a great night where we laughed. Maybe this is enough, I thought. Our friends didn't think so. One sent us to another therapist named Sally, whom our friend credited with saving her marriage. Like the good Christian sister therapist before her, Sally also marveled at how we ever got past the dating stage, but she was committed. We lied to Sally constantly. Chris and I were both terrified of being judged. When one of us would go out on a limb and share some uncomfortable truth, the other person would act blindsided. My eyes would widen like I couldn't begin to comprehend where any of this was coming from. I wanted Sally to like me, so I couldn't tell her the truth. I wanted to win. Sally called me on my competitiveness pretty early in our sessions. You think in terms of winning and losing, she said. But if you're winning, who's losing? Him! That's your husband, she said slowly, like this might be news to me. You're not supposed to want him to lose. Wow, I said. You don't know me, huh? Chris decided to stop coming to the appointments. I kept right on like the good student I was, needing that A. Now that we're here alone, you need an exit strategy, she said, leaning in. Why don't you give yourself 6 months to mentally, physically, financially prepare to leave? Sally was talking truth now. I kept going alone, and I started to get a plan together. There was an actual date in my calendar, and the date came and went. I knew the milk was not just spilled all over the floor. It had been left out to curdle, and I was spooning it up, saying, I can still eat cereal with this. Then Cameron Camera entered my life. That's not her real name. Her working name was even dopier, and I resent protecting the identity of a woman who tried to extort me after sleeping with my husband, but I am not sure of the etiquette. Chris and I went to a summer potluck with a bunch of couples. There was this woman there, serving up sexy librarian and being very flirty with all the husbands. At one point, a bunch of guys were missing, and I found her showing them all her website, Cameron Camera, where people paid to watch her in various stages of undress. Great potluck, everyone. Gentlemen, hide your hard-ons. A lot of people wanted to go out after the potluck night, including Chris, but I had a girlfriend drive me home. He ended up hooking up with Cameron Camera in our SUV. And of course she left an earring, probably one she got 10 for a dollar at a pharmacy for just such occasions. That gave her the excuse to call him at his office, the one I got feng shuied, which gave him the excuse to have sex with her again. Since you came all the way out to Century City, the least I can do is fuck you. Cameron Camera laid low for quite some time, surfacing when she heard I had the Honeymooners movie coming out. She contacted a bunch of tabloids and entertainment news shows, saying she was ready to sell proof that Gabrielle Union's husband was cheating. A friend at one of the shows gave my team a heads up. Before telling me about the woman, they hired Marty Singer, legal guard dog and bad cop to the stars. I was downstairs in my dining room when my cell phone rang. At the other end were my agent, my manager, my publicist, and special guest star Marty. "Listen," my manager said, "this is a really hard conversation to have." Oh my God, I thought, they're dropping me. "I'll just say it," he said. "Someone is shopping around a story that Chris is cheating on you. She has photos." "Oh," I said quietly, then louder. "Oh." And I laughed. I howled. "Gabrielle?" said my publicist. "Which woman?" I asked. Chris was upstairs, and I spoke to the ceiling. "Trust me, this isn't a problem." "Her name is Cameron," said my publicist. "Oh, Cameron Camera with the nudie site," I said, blurting it out like a charades answer to show how cool I was with this. "She's not even cute. I'm so sorry she bothered you. Please don't worry." "It might not be so easy," my agent said. "You have a movie coming out. We need to know what the pictures are so we can warn the studio. Like, if it's kissing..." "Whatever," said my manager. "If it's her hand up his ass..." "Got it," I said. "Hand up the ass is a problem." "So we need to see what she has," said Marty. "Set up a sting and put a price on those photos. In the meantime, talk to Chris and see what she has on him." Like he was waiting for his cue, Chris came down the stairs, the same ones I'd fallen down a few months before. "You didn't notice the flashbulbs?" I asked. "What?" "When she was taking pictures of you guys fucking, you didn't notice the flash going off?" "What?" Maybe he was in straight denial, or, like me, was trying to figure out which woman it could have been. "Cameron Camera, remember her?" I said casually, like I was jogging his memory. "You fucked her last summer?" "Well, she waited for just the right moment. Now she's gone to all these people saying she has proof that you cheated. Anything you want to say?" Just like how we began, when he got caught with the Greek, he went right into groveling. "Get out," I screamed. "I'm about to have to pay a bitch for fucking my husband, and I have to pay Marty Singer to help me pay her. Your dick keeps costing me money." He was panicked, but not about losing his wife. If I left, the cash flow would go with me, and with it, the illusion of his success. I became fixated on the word sting, which they set up that week for 7 a.m. in a coffee shop. All the intrigue made the situation sound at least slightly more exciting than just asking, pretty please, to see exactly what position the woman was in with my husband. I kept my phone in my hand all morning, but Cameron Camera never showed. Either she didn't really have proof and didn't think we'd ask to see it in exchange for the money, or she just wanted to feel relevant. My marriage was obviously over, but I was still desperately afraid of people labeling me a failure, so I didn't want to jump right into the divorce either. Carrie Fisher had a line I love about why she and Paul Simon ended their marriage. Things were getting worse faster than we could lower our standards. I realized that I needed to really take stock of the situation between Chris and me and make a decision based not in anger, but in what I really wanted and how I really felt. So one night, I was sitting up in our bed when he came in the room. "Let's talk," I said. "Yeah," he said. "Listen," I said, "if we're going to have this conversation, let's be brutally honest." "Okay," he said, sitting down next to me. "The truth." We went through it, question by question, bringing up even the most obscure things from years prior. "When you said you got into a fight at Mel's Diner in Hollywood," I asked, "was that true?" "No," he said. "I was with somebody." "You went through the motions of tearing your shirt?" "Yeah." "I knew it," I said, laughing. "The way it was torn. I knew it." He brought up an actor I had done a film with. Did you sleep with him? He asked. No, I said. Were you in love with him? Yes, I said. Yes, I was. But you would have been in love with him too. There was something about the permission to be honest that allowed us to reestablish the friendship we had in the beginning. That night, we decided to split up, and yet, in the months after, we became sort of best friends again. We hung out more in those months than when we were married. Before, we had been that downer couple that ruined the party when we showed up. It was that uncomfortable to be in our presence. But as separated people, our friends were like, hey, we can hang! When we announced the separation, my team gave a statement to the AP at 9 a.m. West Coast time. By 9:15, my publicist and manager started what they called the divorce list. Reps for athletes and celebrities were calling to see if they could set up a date. Some were reaching out directly. My manager called to tell me I was popular. Who? I said, pretending to be disgusted but feeling flattered. Who wouldn't give me a day? He reeled off the first two, naming an aging sportscaster and then maybe a fading music producer who held on to his jerry curl 2 decades too long. Okay, I said, I'm good. Please stop. The honeymoon period of my divorce from Chris was short-lived, and I did the laundry list of dumb things you do when you want your ex to like you. I invested in a company he started with one of my friends. I paid rent for 6 months on a new home for him and co-signed for a Porsche. Then he abandoned the Porsche at the Burbank airport, and I inherited a bunch of bills and parking tickets. The business failed, so there went that money, too. And like my money, I have never seen him again. Chris moved to Atlanta, where I shoot Being Mary Jane. I reached out to him once and said, let's get together. I meant it, but he owes me so much money, I'm afraid he thought it was a trap. He never showed. He needn't worry. My sting days are behind me. Chapter 11. Prescription for a Breakup. Are you experiencing heartbreak accompanied by nutty behavior? Symptoms include, but are not limited to, obsessively clocking your ex's social media and light stalking of the new girl's Instagram. You may also be having moderate to severe instances of driving past their house and hiding in their bushes. You have been given a diagnosis of generally crazy, unproductive behavior. I am here to help. What I can prescribe is not medication, but an easy-to-follow syllabus and wine list. This is a list of pro tips best used now. Pro tip. Watch Splendor in the Grass. Shot in luscious technicolor, Splendor in the Grass is Warren Beatty's first film and one of Natalie Wood's best. She plays Deanie, a pre-depression Kansas girl who understandably falls in lust and love with Warren's bud. He loves her too, but has sex with been-there-done-that Juanita instead. Deanie wants to have sex with Bud so badly that repressing the desire drives her insane. Everyone who I make watch this film remembers this one doozy Deanie tosses out during her mad scene in the bathtub. Did he spoil me? No. No, Mom. I'm not spoiled. I'm not spoiled, Mom. I'm just as fresh and I'm virginal like the day I was born, Mom. My mom loved Natalie Wood, so I grew up watching this film and her others like West Side Story and Rebel Without a Cause. Junior year of high school, I needed Splendor in the Grass to help me get through my first and perhaps worst breakup. Only then was I able to fully understand Deanie and feel understood myself. She and I knew the truth. Heartbreak feels like a death sentence. I thought Jason Kidd and I were a power couple. He was a sophomore at a nearby Catholic high school, quickly becoming a national phenom. But part of the allure for me was that he seemed like such a good guy. He came from a two-parent household, and he was Catholic like me. We had this very eighth-grade relationship, despite being in high school. We didn't have sex. I had already lost my virginity, so I was down for it. But it didn't seem like something he had to have in order to be with me. 2 weeks before my junior prom, I went to one of his games. My friends couldn't go, and I didn't want to do the 30-minute drive from Pleasanton by myself, so I asked my dad if he would come along. He loved that I was dating Jason, so that was a no-brainer for him. We sat in the stands, and I saw his parents were in the bleachers across the gym. Next to them was a tall girl with an asymmetrical haircut like Salt's from Salt and Peppa, only even shorter on one side and longer on the other. I took her to be a cousin or family friend. She was wearing Jason's number 32 wristband, and I thought, how sweet, he gave his cousin his wristband. Then I noticed he was wearing a number 22 wristband. When you, as a player, wear someone else's jersey number, it means one of two things. You are paying tribute to a significant other who plays, or you are honoring a player who died. Now, my number was 21, so I made up this scenario in my head about who number 22 could be. My teenage levels of narcissism and drama wrapped in a crazy double helix of denial. I decided Jason had a friend who died. Jason was so sensitive paying homage to this person via a sweatband. R.I.P. number 22. I hardly knew you. During the game, a few of his friends came over to me, led by a female friend of his with a severe case of a Valley Girl accent. "So, are you and Jason going to prom?" she asked. "Yeah," I answered innocently. "I might, like, hold off on those plans." I flew right past the obvious dig. Why would Jason be busy? We had talked about prom. He didn't have a game. Clueless Valley Girl. Then a guy friend of his came up to me. "Hey, you know, whatever happens with you and Jason," he said, pausing for a second, "you know we're always going to be friends. I think you're really cool." "Oh," I said, "okay." See, this is what grown-up love was about. You created connections with his friends, and even though you know you will never, ever break up, because that would be preposterous, right, you keep those friendships you made. I filed that knowledge away for a time I would never, ever need it. Jason's team won, and right after the game ended, the high school gymnasium ritual of pushing in all the bleachers began. Jason was already doing post-game interviews in high school, so they had left one of the bleachers open for the entire team to sit and wait for him. He was literally surrounded by a ring of reporters. And at 6'4" as a sophomore in high school, he was head and shoulders above the crop of people jotting down what he said. I could clearly see his face as I stood standing off to the side with my dad. Across from us, pointedly not saying hello, were Jason's parents and this girl cousin. Then his teammates started a chant. "Just do it, you pussy! Just do it!" Over and over, and Jason kept looking at me, and then back at the team, and then back at me. My dad smelled what was coming. "We should go, Nikki," he said, as if the idea had just occurred to him. "We should just get out of here." "Just do it, you pussy," the chant continued. "Just do it." "We need to talk," Jason yelled to me over the reporters. They all turned to look at me. The chant stopped, and the gym was silent, except for the squeaks of sneakers as his teammates leaned forward in anticipation. "Let's go, Nikki," Dad said. "No, Dad," I said, in my most dramatic voice. "I want to know the truth." But I couldn't let go of hope. "Is it positive?" I said, giving the thumbs up sign. "Or is it negative?" Jason gave a thumbs down sign. The team went, "Oh," in unison. Condemned to death by heartbreak, I ran from the arena. He called me that night to officially break up with me, which is exactly what he had done to the girl he dated before me. Karma is a bitch that surfaces quickly. I went into this very quick whirlpool of a downward spiral. I began writing a lot of sad, terrible poetry. I even incorporated my vocabulary words into the verse with lines like, "You are the crystal sextant leading me to my fate." Then there was a poem I called Little Boys. Little boys like to play childish games from night to day. They think they're grown, but to their dismay, they're years from where manhood and maturity lay. The fact that I remember this 30 years later speaks volumes about where I was at that time. It's just one from a full three-ring binder of musings on my despair. I asked myself if number 22 gave Jason more than I did as number 21. Just as Deanie tortured herself over Juanita, I wonder if I had been naive to think he didn't want sex. Was that the deal breaker? 'Cause geez, tell a girl. I also had the terrible realization that I now had 2 weeks to find a date for fucking prom. I'd just been dumped by Jason Kidd, so it had to be a good date. There was another black kid that had moved to Pleasanton, a guy named Walter. He was a senior when I was a junior, and he was the running back on the football team. He was really cute, and I decided his looks alone made him my best candidate. Even though my heart was still broken, the pictures would tell a different story. As one of my girlfriends said, "The pictures are going to last a lot longer than your memory." My vanity about the optics was so consuming, I even convinced myself I had a crush on him. It was him all along. To hell with Jason. I just had to actually talk to Walter first. I decided that the best way to not take another hit to my dignity was to ask him in the most casual, devil-may-care way, if I just ran into him and tossed it off. Walter lived in the Val Vista development, right at the entrance to a cul-de-sac. Saturday afternoon, I decided to do a drive-by in my mom's Cutlass Sierra. I went by the house and didn't see anybody around. I was relieved and realized that this was a fool's mission. Worse, I realized that the problem with doing a drive-by in a cul-de-sac, that it's actually two drive-bys. I went around the circle, and as I was a few houses down from passing again, his garage door started to open. Shit! I gunned the engine and saw his dog flying down the driveway. This crazy dog ran right in front of my car, and I panicked. The teen driver and her mom's Cutlass hit the gas instead of the brake. The last thing I saw was his dog jumping from my mom's hood ornament. I braked again and looked behind me. The dog was running in circles fine. He had crouched under my car as I ran over him. Stunt dog. I pulled over and had the shakes. I just did a drive-by of my faux crush's house and almost crushed his dog. Lesson learned, I just called him. I didn't tell him I was only choosing him for the optics, and karma got me. A week before prom, Walter got the goddamn chicken pox. He was no longer contagious on the big night, but he was covered head to toe in chicken pox scabs. Through Splendor in the Grass, I also saw the way out. In the film, spoiler alert, Deanie tries to kill herself and her parents have her institutionalized. This is the part you need to see, my brokenhearted one. While she's locked up, Bud goes to Yale and completely blows it. His family loses everything when the stock market crashes and he has to come home and work the ranch. Deanie, sprung from the nut house, gets a new dude and goes to see Bud. She's got her rich girl gloves on, and she's at their filthy farm with chickens everywhere. There's Bud, working with his dirty hands and hanging out with his new girl, who looks like a mess. You see it in Deanie's face. Whew! I dodged a bullet. So I say to my patients, the friends going through a bad split, you are Deanie. We waste our nutty on people who don't deserve it. Wait it out. He's going to end up dirty with chickens and number 22, and you're going to come out on top. Trust me on this one. Pro tip. Watch Waiting to Exhale and live in the soundtrack. This is for when things get really messy, as they did for me in my early 20s when I couldn't wait for my Greek-Mexican beauty school dropout to break up with me and then would do anything to get him back. Alex and I had moved to L.A. together against the wishes of his parents, who called him a nigger lover. So there was that little hurdle. I was still at UCLA, and I used my own student loan and my Payless settlement money to finance his beauty school tuition. I hated the Payless money and saw it as blood money, payment for being put in an unsafe situation that allowed me to be raped. Alex had no problem with taking that money, and in many ways saw it as something he had a right to because of what, he said, we had been through. That was bad enough. But then he dropped out. This was a habit. He'd gone to junior college to play basketball and then enrolled at California State University, Northridge, but didn't stay. Now, he didn't even want to finish his hours to get his license from beauty school. All he had left was basketball. Every day, he would just play pickup basketball games at a court in Burbank, right around the Disney Studios. Not for money, mind you. There was no hustling in the least. It was just one endless loop of pickup games. His ambition didn't match mine, and as I completely supported him, I began to resent the other costs I was paying for being in an interracial relationship. We got snickers and stares everywhere we went, and his parents had wanted nothing to do with me until they saw the depth of his emotion when I was raped. It just wasn't worth it if I couldn't respect him. I bought the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack just before I drove home to Pleasanton for Christmas break. I listened to it all the way there and all the way back. There are 5 stages of grieving love, and they are all there in that soundtrack. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I resolved to end things with Alex through listening to those songs. But I didn't know how I was supposed to leave someone who was so absolutely dependent on me. In Pleasanton, I ran into Keith, who had been a senior at a nearby high school back when I was a freshman. Home for Christmas, we met up at a bar in Old Town Pleasanton. He was a star soccer player who got a scholarship to UCSB, and now he was in law school in San Diego. We hit it off and exchanged information, and we kept talking. He was very much like me if I hadn't had those Omaha summers to undo parts of my assimilation. He was so terminally corny. I fell in deep like with Keith and began lying to Alex about reasons to go to San Diego. On the drives, I listened to my angst soundtrack of Whitney Houston, Chaka Khan, and Toni Braxton. As Toni sang Let It Flow, I liked the idea of Keith even more. There was never an, oh my God, I want to fuck you moment, but when you are young and you start thinking that if you want to be a grown-up, you need a resume guy. Someone who looks good on paper. Keith could be that guy for me. My plan was to become brazen enough about Keith that Alex would break up with me. It's a trick I learned from my dad. You create a bad enough situation that the other half of the partnership just wants out. After all, Alex had always said, if I ever find out that you're cheating, I'm just going to leave. One day, I was driving down Wilshire and Westwood, just leaving the UCLA campus in my little Miata. My pager went off. Call me grandma and I'll kill you. But this is how we texted in the olden days. It was Alex. 911, it read, which is how we kids expressed, call me back now. Then the numbers 04, which upside down spell out ho. Oh, I said when I read ho. I pulled into a 76 gas station on Wilshire and went to a payphone. Get home now, was all Alex said. I am not joking. My heart was dancing. He knew something and had called me a ho. The nuclear option was in play and I didn't have to do a thing. I listened to Whitney's Exhale, Shoop Shoop, on repeat the whole drive on the 405, joy filling me as I practiced my sad face. Oh my God, I rehearsed in a flat, dull voice. I can't believe this. Alex was waiting with an envelope in his hand, addressed to me from Keith. I had two realizations. First, Alex had opened my mail, which just seemed rude. Second, corny Keith